This is Friday, September 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming up, as refugees and migrants continue to stream into Europe, the United States is deciding how many should be permitted into the country. We'll talk with VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins about that. Scientists are calling it a new humanoid species that has been found in South Africa.
I've been working in paleoanthropology for 25 years, and this is the most significant discovery in that time.
You'll hear from one of the chief scientists behind the project. Also, we talk with a South African woman who has come up with a way to safely feed and empower poor African women. It's all ahead on International Edition. Here on International Edition, we start with the story of refugees and migrants continuing their trek from the Middle East and many other areas of the world into Europe for the most part. But as this migration continues, the United States is making plans to change the number of refugees from Syria in the coming budget year. We welcome to International Edition VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins. Pam, what is the State Department saying about the addition in the number of the Syrian refugees who are going to be accepted in the U.S. next year?
Well, Ira, the Obama administration is saying the United States will take in at least 10,000 Syrians over the next year. And that compares to a total of about 1,600 that have been admitted since the start of the Syrian civil war. The State Department says the Syrians who will be considered will come from the 17,000 or so Syrian refugees who have already been referred to the United States by the United Nations Refugee Agency. They will still have to undergo the vetting process, which can take from 18 to 24 months. The State Department says also that people who arrive in the United States under the refugee status are required to apply to become lawful permanent residents, green card holders, after a year, and that they can be eligible to file for U.S. citizenship after about 5 years.
You spoke to a Syrian American who's trying to get loved ones here into the United States but failed to do that. What did he have to say about that?
Yes, Bilal Kanawadi, he's been in the United States since 1989, and he'd been trying to bring over his cousin. The family includes a husband, a wife, four children, and an elderly aunt. He said they have been living in a dangerous part of Damascus that has been facing constant shelling. He said he hired a lawyer, filled out the required paperwork, spent thousands of dollars in legal fees, and waited for about a year. And when he finally heard back from U.S. officials, the request had been denied, no explanation given. He says that in the aftermath, unfortunately, the family's 15-year-old daughter died in Syria. She had a medical condition, and the family was unable to get her to a medical facility in time to help her. He did say on a bright side that with this new information from the White House that he will try again to get the family to the United States next year.
How are refugee relief organizations reacting to this decision to boost the number of Syrian refugees?
Well, some relief organizations are actually disappointed with the Obama administration's numbers for Syrian refugees. They wish that the number had been even higher for the number that will be considered for U.S. admission. The International Rescue Committee in particular, and this is a group that helps refugees resettle in the United States, it said it was dismayed by the White House announcement, considering that there are over 4 million Syrians who are now displaced outside of the country. The group's president, David Miliband, said the U.S. offer is of cold comfort to the millions of Syrians who are victims of the conflict. Germany, for example, by comparison, is talking about taking in as many as 800,000 Syrians in the coming years. There's also been some pushback from lawmakers on Capitol Hill, such as Congressman Peter King. They've expressed concern about the possibility of terrorists slipping in with the refugees.
Pam Dawkins is VOA's State Department correspondent. And Pam, thanks so much for being with us here on International Edition.
Thank you.
Well, also joining us in our Washington studios is International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Jeffrey, as Pam mentioned, there is opposition in the United States to the decision to admit more refugees from Syria. You talk with someone who has some kind of explanation about that, right?
Yes. In fact, I interviewed John Norris, and John is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress here in Washington. And he said that there are lawmakers, especially now in this political cycle with a presidential race coming up, who are using the immigration issue, especially Syrian refugees, as a talking point, and some people say a bashing point.
I think that's fair. There are some people out there who worry that accepting refugees from the Middle East would lead to a wave of terrorism, or that these are all people who are just fleeing as some secret plot to invade the soft underbelly of the United States. You know, I don't think we've seen a lot of record that actually supports that. Frankly, if you're looking to get a terrorist in the United States, having them flee on foot and be processed through five different countries and eventually get admitted to the United States as a refugee seems like a pretty difficult way to do it. And those expatriates in the United States, in those handful of cases where they became involved in terrorism, every single example I can think of were people who became radicalized long after they'd been in the United States. So, but, you know, it's a political issue. It's a political football. But I think that it's one of those things where we have to recognize that we are a nation of people that are drawn as immigrants, as refugees, and that ultimately that's been a strength for this country.
Yesterday, the White House announced that at least 10,000 Syrian refugees will be admitted during the new fiscal year that begins on October the 1st. When I was talking to Mr. Norris, I asked him, why is the United States so far behind other countries in opening its doors to accept refugees?
Well, you know, it's a complicated question in some ways. The United States continues to be very generous in terms of providing humanitarian assistance to refugees and IDPs from Syria and Iraq, and is the world's largest donor. But in terms of actually taking refugees into our own borders, particularly from Syria, we've got a pretty paltry reputation and record so far. This last August, we took a grand total of 251 Syrian refugees. Last fiscal year, we took a grand total of 1,500. When you look at what Germany's done, what Sweden's done, our numbers look pretty paltry in comparison.
Interesting, Jeffrey, but there is still criticism, and criticism not only because of the reasons the United States isn't accepting as many people and the speed, the slowness of it, or comparative slowness of it, but not doing its part. I mean, what are people saying about that?
Well, if you compare it to what's going on in Europe, the head of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, announced just the other day that the EU is going to take in 160,000. Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, has said that Germany may take in 800,000. But we vet every single person. And this is why it is so slow and it's so long, because they have to go all the way back to Syria and try to investigate, who are these people? What were they doing? Do they have any jihadi connections? Are they dangerous? We don't know. And that's what's keeping the logjam going and slowing down the influx of refugees to the United States, Ira.
Jeffrey Young, thank you so much once again. In the studio, also with us is Andrew Palczewski, our social media editor. And Andrew, a lot of people have been talking about migrants, but also this is 9/11. We'll hear about it in just a few minutes on International Edition. But what are people saying about that on social media?
Well, we've been seeing throughout the morning, as the events of 9/11 have been remembered, the specific times of the events, we've seen moments of silence. We've seen in New York the reading of the names of the people who died on September 11th, 2001 in the attacks, the nearly 3,000 victims. So we've been seeing a lot of remembrances for specific victims. We've been seeing people saying, I remember where I was on that day, remembering their own personal story. Some of those are very compelling. Some people saying, I remember where I was 14 years ago. I was on the 67th floor, and I said, I have to get out of the building when the plane hit. And those kind of stories are just telling and just interesting stories on social media. We have Ari Fleischer, who was the press secretary for President George W. Bush. On September 11, 2001, he was with the president as he was crisscrossing the country trying to get back to D.C. from Florida, where he was doing a reading at a school. Ari Fleischer has done this for the last 2 years on Twitter. He's live tweeted kind of where he was at each moment throughout that day. So you can follow that along on Twitter. It's very interesting to hear about the different elements of that day that we really are behind the scenes, that we didn't know until very recently, about the moves that the president made, about where they were going to across the country to different military bases. So it's really just a kind of inside look on the day and how it transpired.
Well, a lot of people, including you, probably weren't around when this happened at 9/11. Our whole younger generation.
I'm not quite that young, but no, okay, I was very young though. And actually, this is a good point though. There are a lot of people that weren't around. Young people, the incoming freshmen, high school freshmen, were either just born or hadn't been born yet when September 11, 2001 happened. So it's interesting that social media has kind of become a living history where you have people, older people sharing their stories, saying this is where I was, saying, you know, I survived even, or remembering their family members they've lost and sharing that with younger people. So it's interesting, you have a lot of younger people saying never forget, but they weren't even there when it happened.
Well, it happens in every generation for something. Unfortunately, this is 9/11. As always, Andrew, thank you. Social media editor Andrew Palcheski. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Earlier this year, the mysterious bright spots that were spotted on the dwarf planet Ceres stoked the imagination of people everywhere. Now, NASA has released some new high-detail images of those bright spots that were captured by its Dawn spacecraft. The brightest of these mysterious spots are located within the Oculator crater on Ceres. NASA says that these newly released images are giving scientists the closest view yet of the crater and are providing a unique and better understanding of the strange features on the dwarf planet. Since the mysterious spots are much brighter than the surrounding landscape, the Dawn project team actually had to produce composites that were made up of two separate images at the proper exposure for its surroundings. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. Friday marks the 14th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. Observances have been planned across the country in remembrance of the day when four airplanes carried out suicide attacks on the United States. Two of those planes were flown into the World Trade Center in New York City. Another hit the Pentagon, and a fourth crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, before reaching its likely target of Washington, D.C. The Flight 93 National Memorial is marking the completion of its visitor center in memory of the passengers and crew members who carried out a sustained assault against the hijackers for control of that airplane. Shanksville is where it crashed. VOA's Kane Farabaugh is there. Kane, describe the scene there, if you would.
Well, actually, this is now a completely different landscape than it was on 9/11. It was really an abandoned strip mine, and there was a lot of industrial equipment that was there. It was an open field, basically, and the airplane came down in that field towards the edge of the field near a forest. Now, not just the 20-acre site, but perhaps 10 times that is the size of the National Monument that is here in Shanksville. And now, instead of it just being a field, it is a very popular tourist attraction. The visitor center is a $26 million addition to this national monument. It is a very large stone structure with a building between two large stone emplacements. This structure is basically on the hilltop that overlooks the field. So what you can actually do is you can place yourself on the flight path of the airplane in its final moments. And you can look down onto the field from this overlook and see where the final resting place of the 40 passengers and crew now sits.
You've been talking to some of the people who have journeyed there for the remembrance of this day. What did they say to you?
Well, Edward Felt is president of the families of Flight 93. His brother, Edward Porter Felt, was one of the passengers on the airplane. And it's difficult for him to be there. He told me he comes about six times a year. He lives in upstate New York, so he makes the trek down to Shanksville. He said about six times a year. And for him, even though he's been there so many times and traveled thousands of kilometers back and forth, being there even 14 years after the event is still very difficult and very emotional for him. And it's that way with many of the other families. And I think in some ways, even though much time has passed, it hasn't healed all the wounds or eased all of their pain.
That is Kane Farabaugh from VOA, talking from Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the United Airlines flight on 9/11 crashed. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents. a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. A group of scientists announced Thursday what they say is the discovery of an extinct early ancestor of the human being. The discovery is the result of finding a collection of bones in a hard-to-reach section of cave at the Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site outside of Johannesburg, South Africa. We welcome to International Edition John Hawks. Dr. Hawks is an anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is part of the team of scientists involved in the discovery. He joins us from South Africa. Dr. Hawks, thanks so much for being with us. Tell us more about this find, if you will.
Well, we have uncovered what is presently the largest collection of fossil hominin remains ever discovered in Africa. We have more than 1,500 specimens. They represent at least 15 individual skeletons of all ages, from infants up to very old adults. They provide for us an unprecedented picture of the biology of an entire population, and one that is, you know, going to be an important one for everything that we do in our field from now on.
Is this the so-called missing link that scientists have been looking for centuries?
It appears to be related to us in our family tree around the time of those earliest members of Homo. And based on fossils from other parts of Africa, we would think that time was around 2 million years ago. But what we don't know is whether Homo naledi itself is a potential ancestor who lived around that time, or if bones that we've found represent a later time. Species don't become extinct, you know, at the minute that they originate. They last for some time. And so Homo naledi, I'm not prepared to say that it's an ancestor. We don't really look for ancestors. What we do is we take the evidence that we find of relatives and work out from them what the ancestors must have looked like.
Well, there are some indications of this possibility, especially when you come upon the findings that these people or whatever, these creatures lived together and had some kind of societal makeup?
Yes, we find these bones in a very remote section of the Reisenberg cave, a section that can only be reached by traversing through a very narrow passageway that's a vertical climb. We had to recruit special archaeologists who had excavation skills, but also caving and climbing skills, and were really skinny to fit into this very small passage that they had to climb down to get into the chamber.
That is Dr. John Hawks, an anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, part of the team of scientists who Thursday announced its investigation into the find of a new species in a South African cave. It was found a couple of years ago. The results were just revealed yesterday. By the way, this Homo naledi, as it's called, is about 1.5 meters tall, weighed about 45 kilograms. A revolution is taking place in the way perhaps millions of people prepare their meals. 8 years ago, Sarah Collins came up with the concept of the Wonder Bag. Her mission, in addition to providing a safe, healthy, and affordable way for poor African women to cook, was to find a way to empower these women in their lives. And it seems to be working. VOA's Rebecca Ward speaks with Collins now that the Wonder Bag is being marketed throughout most of the world.
Tell me about the Wonder Bag. What makes it so wonderful?
I think the thing that makes the Wonder Bag stand out as opposed to other cooking and alternative cooking solutions is it's culturally relevant, and the behavior change isn't too great. So you start your cooking as you normally would on a fire or a stove, and then put it into the Wonder Bag for it to continue to cook for 8 to 12 hours. So really, it's a very instinctive way of cooking rather than a huge behavior change. And I think that's why it's a simple solution that is creating very wide scale success.
Well, this was, it's such an ingenious idea, but I understand that the concept is really quite old. So what made you think you know, that this was this could, you know, have an impact in a place like Africa?
Well, you know, it is. It's an ancient cooking technology. In fact, it was my grandmother who taught me about it, and I remembered her wrapping pots in blankets. And in 2008, when we had rolling blackouts in South Africa, I really started looking at how we could look at alternatives that were culturally relevant. So I tested cushions around pots in homes in Africa with grandmothers who had orphaned children, and they were bringing them up way below the poverty norms. And the impact in their lives of not having to pay for electricity, firewood, charcoal was astounding. And that's when I knew that this was really going to be a game changer in Africa for women.
Also a game changer because it cuts down on the amount of fuel that they have to, you know, carbon-based fuels, charcoal, that they have to use for cooking. And it also cuts down, I'm presuming, on toxic fumes, which are a cause of death for many in Africa.
Absolutely. You know, Rebecca, I think one of the most unknown facts is the biggest killer in the world is indoor air polluted related diseases, so upper respiratory diseases. And 4 million people die annually. That's more than malaria, HIV combined. And so if you look at the impact of indoor air pollution, smoking, it's radical. So if we can reduce that by up to 80 to 90%, the impact on the children who are breathing in those toxic fumes, as well as the woman, it has a huge impact on health issues in Africa.
VOA's Rebecca Ward speaking with the inventor of the Wonder Bag, Sarah Collins. That's our show. Visit our website at voanews.com.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political violence shows no easing in Burundi with the murder of an opposition party spokesman in the capital, Bujumbura. Patrice Gangu of the UPD Zigamibanga party was shot and killed outside his home September 7th, the second top official of the group slain in the turmoil surrounding President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial decision to run for a third term. Other prominent Burundians have been gunned down in recent months as well, with no suspects arrested. 15 years ago, the spirit of the Arusha Agreement transformed Burundi by enshrining the conviction that the government must represent and serve all citizens. Today, Burundi faces a renewed challenge to end violence and achieve lasting stability by coming together in the spirit of Arusha. This isn't the work of one group, but of every person and party. We call on President Nkurunziza and his government, on opposition leaders, and on all the people of Burundi to join now in an open, comprehensive, and representative national dialogue. Nor is it a challenge for Burundi alone. The United States reiterates its support for regional leadership, including Uganda and the East African Community, to convene and mediate a political dialogue and urges them to do so soonest. High-level engagement by the African Union and the United Nations and positive action by all states in the region is critical to bring Burundi back from the brink. We also remain committed to holding accountable human rights violators and abusers and all those who seek to undermine stability in Burundi. President Nkurunziza is well aware of his nation's crisis and has called for security committees to work together with Burundi's security agencies. That is very worrisome, as it includes armed youth militia, including the armed contingent of the Imbonerakure, the ruling party's youth wing. Militia violence and intimidation have profoundly increased tensions and worsened a crisis that has driven almost 200,000 Burundians to take refuge abroad. To prevent further violence, armed Imbonerakure and all militias must be disarmed immediately, with AU oversight. We call on all Burundians to oppose any further acts of unlawful violence and to join together now in the spirit of Arusha to reach consensus and a peaceful path forward for Burundi.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the